they reminded me of the old good story that the old gentleman was going to marry. And he decided to be straightforward with his wife-to-be. And he said, I have to tell you, I have a problem with my back. I have a problem with my knees. I have a problem with my hearing. She interrupted him and said, what don't you have? And he said, teeth. You know, that is our today's hospitals. Healthcare is brainstorming meetings. That's not how you solve the problem. Right. You're paying with not just billions of extra dollars, but with wasted human lives. At that point, the Institute of Medicine committee found that the waste in the healthcare of this $750 billion a year was in excess of 30%, 30. That's huge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Health Frontiers with Dr. Bob. I'm Dr. Bob, and as usual, we present a very, very informative program involving your health and involving today something very, very special. We're going to be talking today to Dr. Eugene Litvak, and he is a well-known individual within healthcare management, which is a very important topic. He is the president and CEO of the Institute for Healthcare Optimization. He's also an adjunct professor in operations management in the Department of Health Policy and Management at the Harvard School of Public Health. I believe that's called the Chan School, if I'm not mistaken. He teaches a course called Operations Management in Service Delivery Organizations. Prior to this position, Eugene was the co-founder with Dr. Michael Long and director of the Program for the Management of Variability in Healthcare Delivery at the Boston University Health Policy Institute. And he's a professor, was a professor, and maybe still is, I'm not sure, Eugene, if you can tell us, at the Boston University School of Management. Before joining Boston University, Dr. Litvak was a faculty member at the Harvard Center for Risk Analysis. Now, I have to say something else. Dr. Litvak is an author of more than 60 publications in the areas of operation management and healthcare delivery organizations. He was the editor of the Joint Commission's Patient Flow books, Managing Patient Flow in Hospitals, Strategies and Solutions. This is important for all you hospital administrators out there who are going to be watching this show. He edited the second edition and also wrote Optimizing Patient Flow, Advanced Strategies for Managing Variability to Enhance Access, Quality, and Safety. All very important topics that we're going to be talking about today. So how did I meet Eugene? Well, I met Eugene because we were a part of CMS-sponsored programs in New Jersey, CMS being Medicare, for those of you who don't know what CMS is, and there was a partnership established for patients. And New Jersey was a recipient, and the New Jersey Hospital Association put together this fantastic series of projects for both medicine and surgery. So I'm going to start out by asking Eugene to pop up on the screen. And Eugene, it's a great pleasure to have you all the way from cold, cold Boston, Massachusetts. Let me ask you, what does the IHO really do? What is their interest in healthcare?
First of all, thank you for introduction. After you introduce and mention all my affiliation, I become really self-confident. Second, I have to tell you, for those who are curious and believe where my accent is coming from, that believe that I'm from Texas, I'm not. I'm from Ukraine, from former Soviet Union.
Ah.
So what this institute is about, first of all, we are non-for-profit.
Mm-hmm.
That's important to mention. We are education, research, and I would say limited consulting organization. The difference in what we are doing between us and other consulting companies, first of all, we education and research are the biggest part of what we are doing. And second, that we do not give hospitals or outpatient clinic a glossy prints with our recommendation that they would collect the dust on the shelf. We believe that our project is done when they report the outcome. So I hope during this conversation today to mention some results, and those results obtained from the hospitals and outpatient clinics. Those are not our results.
I see. I think that this is probably one of the more important topics that physicians should know about, and also hospital leaders and members of the Joint Commission and other organizations that screen hospitals like the LeapFrog, for example, programs. This is very, very pertinent to how we practice medicine. And I speak now as a physician who's in the trenches on a daily basis. So my next question is, why do you feel it's important to bring the work of the IHO to the fore at this time? I mean, before you answer, this is a time of significant problems in the delivery of healthcare from multiple angles. Yeah. Go ahead, Eugene.
Yeah. First of all, let me build a bridge between your first question and the second one. I'm teaching, as you mentioned, operation management. I'm not doing that the last couple of years, but prior to that, for 20 years plus, I was teaching operations management and healthcare delivery organizations. So I usually tell my students, I'm from the country that does not exist, teaching you a subject, operations management and healthcare, that also does not exist. That's the reason why we are doing that in healthcare. So let us get back to your second question.
Yes.
What's the problem the hospitals experience today? An affordable cost. A really thin margin, sometime on the red, and frequently getting out of business.
Yes.
Second, our emergency departments are overcrowded, dangerously overcrowded, because there were tons of publications showing that that results in increased mortality.
Right. And most patients feel that the emergency room is their primary care physician if they can't afford a primary care physician. Am I right?
Exactly. And the primary care physician is another problem in healthcare today. Like in Massachusetts, for example, the waiting time to get seen, to be seen by primary care physician is in excess of 1 month.
Wow.
So I would say in the current healthcare, you should be really healthy to get sick if you have to wait that long. We are talking about overcrowded EDs, and that's where the pit comes, the show pit comes from.
Yes.
And everybody is giving applause to this and excited about the show, myself included.
Yes.
I think it is amazingly good show.
Absolutely. I have begun to watch it myself with my spouse, and we are glued to the screen when this show is on TV. It's an amazingly true, accurate program.
Exactly. The only problem I see with the PIT, that it was timely 10 years ago. It is timely now, and it will be timely in 10 years unless we do something in healthcare. In right. 10 years, we can show the same thing. Unless we improve patient flow, we will see the same show and believe that it has been filmed yesterday. Then nurses and physicians burn out and live in the hospitals. It's really exodus of nurses from the hospitals, and the hospitals have to pay an excessive price for traveling nurses, and not every hospital can afford it today.
Yes,
so the shortage of nurses becoming worse and worse. Last but not the least, the number of avoidable deaths is very high, measuring in hundreds of thousands avoidable hospital deaths. When we work with hospitals and I hear from our hospital partners, you know, what problem they experience, they reminded me the old good story that the old gentleman was going to marry. And he decided to be straightforward with his wife-to-be. And he said, I have to tell you, I have a problem with my back. I have a problem with my knees. I have a problem with my hearing. She interrupted him and said, what don't you have? And he said, teeth. You know, that is our today's hospitals. It's hard to name the problem that they don't experience.
Right, right. And in that vein, I just have to say that we're in the midst, perhaps something being resolved, but I'm not sure, of a nursing strike in New York City, several major hospitals. And I've lived through, in New York City, two previous nursing strikes, and it's not an easy thing. It just compounds the issue, compounds the problem.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely. And most importantly, it's not going to be resolved.
Yes.
Without reengineering hospital floor, and not just hospital, outpatient clinics as well.
Right.
So nurses demand proper staffing level. Otherwise, they said that the patient will be suffering and it could result in mortality, multiple publications on that.
Yes.
That costs money. And the hospitals are right, saying that in today's environment, we cannot afford it.
Right.
So both of them are right. And unless we address the patient flow that I hope to discuss today, it's a road to nowhere.
Absolutely true. All right. So my next question is, why are there so many problems with the delivery of healthcare in this country, in America?
Well, obviously, I wouldn't say I am biased, but this is my personal opinion. For many, many years, the healthcare was cost-plus reimbursed. At the beginning of my career, we are talking about 30 years ago, if not more, in healthcare, there was practically unlimited cash flow. I remember the time when the hospital, with somebody at the hospital, want to buy another CT scan or MRI machine, and would never face any pushback.
Ah, yeah, it's
so
very
that's one reason why the efficiency was not on the radar screen. The second thing, I would like frequently these two fields are being confused, healthcare and medicine. I believe that healthcare, to the extent I can judge, healthcare is absolutely amazing field. I think doctors do miracle. And you never give medication without the clinical trials, without several clinical trials, repeated clinical trials, discussions, debate, etc. Healthcare delivery, unlike medicine, is not a science. Is absolutely not a science. We solve this problem by brainstorming, meetings, etc. Could you imagine that if somebody on the market offer a new medication and would decide whether to give it to patient based on a brainstorming?
Yes.
Brainstorming.
Yes.
That would be ridiculous and dangerous.
Right.
Yet in healthcare, we're doing exactly that.
Wow.
Another thing that what do we have in medicine? We have standards. We have FDA that subjected any innovation, any new medication, any new procedure, subjected to clinical trials. And depending on the results, may approve or disapprove this medication or intervention. Nothing in healthcare. We just are trying. It reminds me my homeland, the famous physiologist Ivan Pavlov.
Yes.
You know, when I see how the healthcare problems are being addressed, sometimes I feel like I want to say, I'm sorry, he's not involved in that. Maybe all this idea should be first tried on the dogs.
Yes.
You know, so again, healthcare is brainstorming, meetings. That's not how you solve the problem.
Right.
You're paying with not just billions of extra dollars, but with wasted human lives.
Absolutely true. And you are a scientist and you are a mathematician who has solutions for these problems, at least those that we've seen to date. So then my next question is, do you have any ideas about the cost of healthcare, the waste, the inefficiencies that we all see, that society sees, and we read about in the newspapers daily? And this goes into Medicaid, Medicare, Obamacare, and other programs that are supposed to be there to help patients.
that talking about healthcare cost is very difficult not to become emotional.
Okay.
So let me recall, I had the privilege to serve on the 2012 on the Institute of Medicine Committee on Better Health at the Lower Cost. And what we found there, that at that point, that was 2012, and the cost of the healthcare overall, U.S. healthcare cost, was ridiculously low as compared to the current healthcare cost. It was just $750 billion a year. It's nothing as compared as today, it's almost $6 trillion.
$6 trillion
at that
year.
Point.
Wow.
$6 trillion. Now, we're approaching or already approach. Last year, it was $5 trillion plus.
How come these numbers have skyrocketed?
Look, you know, if you and I would have the same budget and you would be frugal and I would be playing in a casino every day, you know?
Yes.
Maybe there would be some waste, I would guess, on my hand, you know? Because it's not nobody's money. Taxpayers' money, it's nobody's money.
Right, right.
So at that point, the healthcare, the Institute of Medicine Committee found that the waste in the healthcare of this $750 billion a year was in excess of 30%, 30. That's huge.
Mm. Amazing.
That's amazing. And what happened since then? We learned that we have to reduce healthcare cost. So it moved from $750 billion to $6 trillion now.
Wow.
And that's not the end of the story. According to the, I believe, is a congressional budget a prediction that by the year 2033, just in 7 years, Medicare would become insolvent, and the healthcare cost would be growing 9% a year, and by 2033, it would be would grow by 86% as compared to 2025.
Wow. Wow, wow, wow.
It's just scary. Nobody can afford it.
No.
Nobody can afford it.
So you're talking that instead of $6 trillion, you're talking probably $12 to $13, to maybe even $15 trillion.
Maybe. Yes. I don't want to do it on the fly. But again, it's as compared to the last year, we are talking about over 80% increase.
Wow. That's amazing. Go ahead.
If I may, I would like to show one side.
Yes.
I would talk about hospitals at this moment.
Yes, yes.
And if I may, I am technically challenged, but let me try to share my slide. That's this variable line is the line of the hospital bed occupancy census. And this is the photo or the plot of pre-COVID hospital. And that is a real hospital that I call this hospital. When they asked me what the name of this hospital, I say, I call it not my hospital.
Right.
Because nobody wants to acknowledge that that's a case. And yet it's a case at practically every hospital. So what does that mean? What do we see on this plot? The red dashed line. At the peak level of hospital bed occupancy, that's how we staff beds many, many years, dozens and dozens of years ago.
I see.
Nobody can afford it. So how do we staff today? We look at the budget of the last year, and let's say this is a red bold line, and we say that we will staff next year on that level. So, but the average census is never the case. The average census is meaningless. It's like an average temperature at the hospital. It makes no sense and gives no benefit.
Right.
So what happened in this case? And that has been documented in multiple publications, and I'm not a co-author of either of them. it results when you have a kick above this red bold line. Today's staffing, we have medical errors, readmissions, overcrowding, infections, elevated mortality. And that's a reason for demand for nurse staffing ratio. That's why nurses demonstrate. Right. They don't want, when they staff on this red bold line, they don't want to staff to take care of the patients at the peak level. They're right, just not capable of that.
Right.
And the mortality would increase. So what I would like to say, as long as we have those peaks above the red bold line,
yes,
we will have all these consequences in the right corner in the red font. No matter. I don't want to minimize the importance of what hospitals are doing today. AI, other things, which are absolutely needed. But I would tell that there is a prerequisite. As long as you have this peak above this average staffing level, red bold line, you will have all these red fonted consequences in the upper corner, right corner of the plot.
Right.
No matter what else do you do.
What is that big red arrow that is pointing up? Is that the...
It shows what happened during the peak.
I see. Okay. During the peak.
Everything below is a waste. If you talk today to any hospital, they say, oh, we always have a peak. We always have 100%.
Yes.
100% bed occupancy. That's not the case. If you will always have 100% of bed occupancy, you will never be able to perform any emergency surgery or admit a patient from the ED. There would be simply no room for them.
Right.
So it's variable. And this red bold line already, I'm trying to be conservative.
Mm-hmm.
This red bold line already is over 50% of the entire hospital budget.
Mm.
And how much do we spend on the entire hospital budget? It's about one third of the overall healthcare expenses.
Mm.
So if you're talking about 2.6 trillion, again, the number might be a little bit lower. I'm not quoting the number of current number, but it's approaching six. If you look at this number, then we spend on hospital care about one third.
Mm-hmm.
$2 trillion a year. That's a budget of several European countries combined.
Yes. Wow.
GDP of several European countries combined. And that is not enough. So why it's not enough? Because the hospitals are wasteful.
Mm-hmm.
That's a reason. Or because there is no science in managing patient flow. So the idea is to smooth those peaks. As long as we have those peaks, we will have these consequences. So we have to smooth those peaks. If you go on the street and ask a stranger, describe the hospital. Typical hospital has more than 50% admission through the emergency department. That's a main portal to the hospital. The next one would be scheduled admission. Mostly surgical, but it could be cath lab as well. And the remaining, about 30-35%. The remaining 15% are typical. I mean, there are different hospitals. The remaining 15% are medical referrals, transfers, you name it.
Right.
So if you ask a stranger on the street, what is the main reason that we have those peaks? They will tell the emergency departments.
Mm.
Because the volume is higher and their admissions, their arrivals to the emergency department is not predictable. Quite to the contrary. That is not true. Again, they would provide this answer based on the common sense. But we know already that the common sense and the healthcare delivery is not compatible today.
Right, right.
So that is why the answer is that those are elective admissions. They are more variable than arrivals to the emergency department.
Yes.
What does that mean? That it is easier for somebody to predict when somebody will break leg and come to the emergency department
mm-hmm.
then when elective admission will take place.
Mm.
That's far from being scientific.
Absolutely true.
That is in our hand to small those peaks and valleys.
Right.
And yet we don't do that. And as long as we don't do that, just one minute, I want to add something to that.
Yes.
We people assume, and that's where the hospital C-suite is wrong.
Yes.
They assume, okay, if Eugene is right, and by the way, there is a published study that could be found on our website, the published study in a media source, Cures, a study of the entire New York State of all 1.6 million admissions. And they compare admissions through the ED and compare admissions, scheduled admissions. And in the plot, you can see obviously that admissions to the ED are pretty steady state during weekdays. Hmm. If you come to the ED today and short of epidemic, bus crash or whatever, and ask nurse manager, today is Sunday is not a good example, but let me give you Monday or Tuesday or whatever. 5 Tuesdays from now, how many patients would be admitted? Again, short of the bus crash in front of the hospital, they will give you pretty accurate number, not exact, but pretty close. If you come to figure out how many scheduled admissions are going to take place in 5 Tuesdays from now, I doubt you will get the answer.
That's interesting. Very interesting.
And the hospital C-suite are afraid of smoothing. They believe that if they will come to surgeons and say, we want to change your block time distribution, then the surgeons would push back and may go to another hospital, and the hospital will lose revenue, and the hospital C-suite, that may cause them job.
Yes, yes.
However, that's not true. That's a myth resulted from ignoring the science. Uh-huh. We've done it at many hospitals. I'm going to mention a few examples, hopefully, later.
Okay.
And there is a huge... Surgeons are the main beneficiaries, they and their patients. They get bigger paycheck, they have significantly lower overtime, they have fewer deaths and medical errors, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes.
So I want to stop at this point, otherwise I can talk for another few hours.
Well, I have more questions to ask you, so don't do that. There is a shortage of doctors and nurses in America, only made worse recently by limits on importation and visa provisions to physicians and to nurses from other countries. Does the IHO feel that this can be remedied? And if you think this influx of physicians and nurses, which is abruptly stopped, can this be remedied? And how so, if so?
First of all, it's a very dangerous trend. And it resulted, all these problems resulted in the mass exodus of the hospital CEOs. There was a piece in the Modern Healthcare a few months ago, when they named multiple hospital CEOs leaving their hospitals because they don't want to work in this environment.
Yes.
Physician and nurses are leaving. Let me tell you, I also would be living if somebody will beat me over the head every day.
Mm.
They work in absolutely abnormal condition. Again, I would refer to the pit. And of course, they are living. Everybody would. If, let's say, you invited a plumber and you want the plumber to take care of your leaking boiler.
Right.
And the plumber would fix it. So that's in plumbing. How about if you and 20 other people would invite the same plumber and he would have to rush from one boiler to another?
Mm-hmm.
What would be the outcome? He would be giving you a lecture of why your boiler is leaking and go to the next client.
I see.
So whether it's possible to fix it, 100%. And example I hope again to provide later, the Mayo Clinic, Florida. In less than 1 year, this at that point, it was small hospital, 211 beds. The margin, because of increased number of surgeries, I want to emphasize that smoothing results in increasing the number of surgeries, not declining. Mm-hmm. It does not result in inconvenience with block changes. What they observe, over 5 million increase in revenue from their OR, not a penny spent for an additional staffer, and nurse turnover, the number of proportion of nurses leaving the hospital in the OR was 41%. Mm-hmm. In less than 1 year, this exodus was halved.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Wow. According to Becker's Hospital Review, there are some 700 potential hospital closures in America. And we've all heard of hospitals closing in the metropolitan area of New York, for example. But in the rural parts of the country, these hospitals are having major issues staying alive. Can you comment on that?
Yes. It's not just rural hospital, unfortunately. And I can only commend healthcare that it's just 700 hospitals, not 3,000, you know? Mm-hmm. I'm surprised with that. There are reasons for that. First of all, let me get back to the rural healthcare. In rural healthcare, you know that it was $50 billion has been assigned to save them. Mm-hmm. First of all, how do we know that it's $50 billion? How do we know that it's not $100?
And who assigned the $50 billion? The government?
Congress, yes.
Congress.
And if you ask why $50 billion, I never heard the answer.
Mm.
Never. So that reminds me the story, like, you know, in the morning, wife gives her husband a dollar and say, please go to your work and don't limit yourself, you know?
Mm-hmm.
We cannot, this $50 billion is drop in the bucket.
Mm.
Second, what happened with this rural or not rural hospitals even? Again, the margin is thin. The hospitals have to close because they have those peaks and valleys where they lose money. They cannot do as many surgeries as they would do if they smooth those peaks. They would not see as many patients if they would if they do that. And how the rural hospitals react to that?
I'm going to get into the mechanism of smoothing because you keep referring to smoothing, and I don't think our viewer understands what you mean by smoothing. But let me just say this, that hospitals in the rural areas are closing their emergency rooms and their maternity. I mean, if you want to deliver a baby in Paducah, wherever that is, you may have to go 75 miles to deliver the baby. And if you break your arm, you may have to go 75 miles to get your arm reset. That's not very good, especially if the hospital's trying to save money by closing its emergency room and its maternity facilities. You've seen that, have you not?
Yes, absolutely. And why it's emergency department maternity wards? Why? Reason why they are being viewed as a low revenue departments.
I see.
They are not cash cows.
Yes.
So getting rid of them is like a balloon, you know, air balloon. When it comes down, you know, you drop the bag with the sand.
Yes.
To make it lighter. That's exactly what is going on. And the healthcare cost going up, the cost of the staff is going up. To hire nurses is more expensive than it was.
Yes.
So the hospitals are trying to minimize it, and it's no longer a healthcare issue.
Yes,
it's a social and economic issue because people would have to travel where the hospital is available.
Yes. All right, let me ask you another question. Tell us a few ways in which your methods have helped hospitals in this country and abroad. And I know you've done some work in Canada, for example. Maybe you can detail for us how this happens. And somewhere along the line, please tell us about smoothing. What the heck is smoothing?
Let me start with that.
Okay, great.
explain it. And that plot, I don't want to put it again, to share it again, but everybody saw it. So what happened today? That if I am a surgeon, and if I am a chief of surgery, let's say, or prominent surgeons who bring significant amount of, a significant volume, case volume of patients, and I have a peak on Monday, and my colleagues also have a peak on Monday. So what happened? I would practically occupy most of the hospital beds.
So you're talking about a peak of surgeries.
Peak
like
of surgeries,
five or six
exactly.
surgeries per doctor. But there's only a limited number of operating rooms. Say there are only four operating rooms.
I would utilize all of them mm-hmm. to the maximum.
Okay.
So I believe fewer beds for a poor cousin in the emergency department. And they become overcrowded during those peaks. It has been documented multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the problem? Should we tell the chief of surgery or prominent surgeon, you should change your block time and you should not do all these surgeries? Not the case. When we are talking about smoothing, we are not talking about every single surgeon performing similar number of procedures during the weekdays. That would be ridiculous and not needed. What we ask them, that if a prominent surgeon on Monday has a peak, then maybe somebody else who is new to the field, who is not that prominent, will change the block time from Monday to Friday, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So as a group that sends patients to the same ward, whether it's orthopedic, urology, or whatever, they would perform similar, not exactly the same, but similar number of procedures every weekday. Ideally, Saturday should be included, but if it's difficult, just the weekdays. Examples that I'm going to provide, I would mention only those who did it during the weekdays, smooth those. And that's not difficult. The practice show, if you have, you know, 10 dozens of surgeons, only a few of them would have to change the block time.
I see.
From one day to another. So it's absolutely painless procedure, but results are amazing, both in mortality and financial.
Now, I've heard that hospitals do not consider themselves, well, this is not applying to medicine, but as far as surgery goes, hospitals are not seven-day events for surgeons. But hospitals are also not seven-day places for other physicians and nurses, even though the patients are there. And a way to solve this several years ago was to hire hospitalists, which are young people who specialize only in hospital care. Has that done anything to help the flow of patients?
It did. But it's not enough. And again, ideal scenario, if the number of elective admissions would be similar from day to day.
Yes.
That would reduce mortality. Wall Street Journal in 2013 published one of my pieces, Don't Do Your Surgery, I Believe, on Thursday. Because on Thursday, the hospitals are full.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened to patients, they have been, and surgeons know that very well, that their patients post-surgically will be placed in the wrong bed, like it happened to the in South Carolina to the teenage boy, Louis Blackman.
Mm-hmm.
One can Google, you'll find thousands of links to different aspects of what happened to him. He had a very successful thoracic surgery on Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
The hospitals are full on Thursday. The active discharge is starting on Friday. So on Thursday was full. And instead of getting to the surgical or thoracic surgery ward, he has been placed after successful surgery, I emphasize, placed in a pediatric oncology. And the nurses are not trained in surgery. So they did not recognize that he has abdominal bleeding. To make a long story short, over the weekend, only residents were there, and the boy died after successful surgery on Monday. How many stories like that happens today?
Yes.
Every day.
Every day. That's tragic.
So for me, I would explain the what is going on by fear of the hospital C-suite to touch operating room. Mm-hmm. My sense that some of them, when you mention operating room, they got mesmerized.
Mm-hmm.
They don't understand that the surgeons would lobby for that if they understand the benefits.
Yes, yes.
But, yeah.
Okay, so let's move on so we can honor the time. You have a number of hospitals. Hospital leaders are not aware of the intervention as the media is focused on problems. Well, I agree with that, rather than practical proven solutions to these healthcare problems. And there were some hospital systems that you're going to mention. If you would briefly mention places like Cincinnati Children's, Ottawa Hospital in Canada, the Mayo Clinic in Florida, could you go on and tell us a little bit about those outcomes and results where you've been involved?
Absolutely. Cincinnati Children's, they completely introduced the smoothing.
Mm-hmm.
They had a real leader, hospital CEO, Jim Anderson. Their outcome, surgeons are much happier, nurses are much happier, plus 137 million dollar margin improvement annually. Plus, they budgeted already a new tower of over 100 million to accommodate those peaks that you saw on the plot.
Yes.
They're very happy with that. So that's just Cincinnati Children's. Would be nice to have it. The hospital has 450 beds at that point. Now, another hospital, University Health Network, that's in Canada, number one in Canada, ranked number three in the world. They significantly increase surgical throughput. They significantly reduce waiting time for emergent and urgent surgeries. The same is true for Cincinnati Children's, which also, in addition to increase surgical throughput and reducing time for emergent and urgent surgeries, they reduce operating room overtime by 57%. That's important for surgeons. So at the University Health Network, they just published a new manuscript like a month or two ago when they show what does it mean for transplant. They are major and probably one of the most successful transplant centers in North America. They reduce the number of waiting time to incision for transplant surgery, and they perform the same or greater number of elective surgery, so there is no competition anymore.
You're talking, Eugene, about transplant. You want to digress for a second and tell us about waste of organs tied to transplants that cannot be done because of this sort of problem with bed accession.
Let me quote the National Academy of Science, Engineering, and Medicine report of February 2022, exactly 4 years ago. It was about healthy organ waste. So many people are waiting for organ and they wasted the organ. Particularly for kidney, that was over 20% waste of healthy kidney ready for transplant.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them fell into Friday. You guess why?
Yes.
National Academy of Medicine said that CMS should implement this smoothing because it's not just improving surgical throughput, not just improving alleviating the overcrowding, but also increasing the number of transplants. And they recommend it nationwide. And what has been done? Nothing.
Nothing.
The Ottawa Hospital in Canada, in less than 1 year, they increased their margin. They did not implement completely this, just 1 year. It was 9 million saving, margin improvement, plus 40 life saved every year due to this project. If all American hospitals will follow their footsteps and will have ROI only 10%, so if each hospital would save not 40 but only 4 lives, that would result in 24,000 lives saved annually. Wow. In the U.S.
That's incredible.
Incredible number. Mayo Clinic, Florida, reported, as I mentioned, 41% reduction in nurses who want to leave.
Yes.
I have to mention another one, only mention, because you were the one who was leading this project in New Jersey when we collaborated.
Yes, yes.
That's Newark Beth Israel. Sorry for stealing your thunder, you know? the results, as far as I remember, was only on telemedicine unit.
Yes.
The number of beds has been reduced. The waiting time in the ED for telemetry bed has been reduced by the factor of 5.
Yes.
And the number of nurses would be saved. 10 plus million saved in just this unit alone.
Yes. And that was due to careful screening of admissions to telemetry.
Exactly.
And telemetry is far more expensive. That's where a heart monitor is placed for the patients out there listening. A heart monitor is placed on the chest to see if you're having irregular heartbeat or having a heart attack or whatever. And the bed cost is a fortune. And if you wind up in the intensive care unit, the bed cost is also double, if not triple, the cost of being a patient in a regular room. So yes, by screening patients in telemetry, we did save a lot of money, and we were very careful to make sure that only the correct number of patients wound up in telemetry. And that fell apart after I left, I believe. It is not carried forward because it is a lot of work on the behalf of several physicians.
Yeah. Lastly, I want to say that it's not just hospital. It's outpatient clinic as well. Federally qualified health center, St. Thomas in Louisiana, in New Orleans, they have most of their patients uninsured, underinsured, or Medicaid recipient. Not a pleasant environment for today. So in their environment, they increase their margin by 1.5 million. Their patients are being seen 80% during the day of their request, 90% during that day and the next day. So they make money, the patients are happy, and that's practically a level of concierge medicine.
My next question is a real doozy. Why do you suppose that the U.S. government cares little about making healthcare more efficient? Is it because Congress, is it because the U.S. Senate really can't put their arms around it, that they don't grasp what the problems are, that there is extraordinary waste, that organs are going fallow because they're not being transplanted in a timely manner? People are upset, nurses are leaving, physicians can't start and are not anxious to be a part of a hospital staff because of some of these issues. Can you zero in and tell us why in this healthcare system, the U.S. government cares very little?
Now, look, I'm subjective. I can only speculate. And don't forget that I came from Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
And in Soviet Union, we used to say that if the government would be in charge of the Sahara Desert, there would be deficit of sand. It's hard for me to explain. This intervention has been published first time 25 years ago.
Yes.
26 years ago. It has been published in a leading medical journal, New England Journal of Medicine, JAMA, Health Affairs. In the past, I emphasize in the past, it has been covered by the Wall Street Journal, Market Watch, Newsweek, Forbes, you name it. Not today. Today, media wants to talk about problems in healthcare. There is a good, Middle Eastern saying that if you would keep repeating the word honey many times, you still would not feel the sweet taste in your mouth. You know,
yes.
what is the benefit of keep repeating the bad, bad, bad?
Right.
When there is
a
solution, somehow neither government nor media is interested.
Right.
The solution I see in CMS getting involved, an American Hospital Association promoting that's the benefit to their constituents. My explanation that most of the hospitals in the U.S. simply are not aware of that. It's not their reluctance. is their ignorance.
Right. Next question is, Obamacare, Medicaid, and even Medicare seem to be at issue for hospitals. How can the IHO attack these problems related to those entities? This is really on the headline of every newspaper in the country right now, where Medicaid is being pulled back, where Obamacare is costing a fortune when it was meant to save money, and where Medicare, as you said at the outset of this interview, where Medicare may become insolvent by 2033. So what do you think? I mean, how is the IHO going to, or is the IHO capable of dealing with this kind of, this magnitude of a problem?
First, about the magnitude. Many years ago, like in 2012, the JAMA published piece that credited this approach, our approach, with 4 to 5% saving in the overall U.S. healthcare cost.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean? If we spend even $5 trillion, let's say, I believe we're close to six, but let's say last year $5 trillion, we are talking about $200 to $250 billion a year, plus thousands of lives saved. I think, you know, I'm shocked that it's not being implemented. As for Obamacare, in 2018, I believe, The Hill published my piece with the title "Another Election Cycle, Another Healthcare Debate."
Mm.
When I discuss Obamacare in details, I said there are two propositions that cover chronic condition and cover kids till 26. Very important. I said the promise to reduce healthcare costs it has not been achieved and will not be achieved. And I was talking about this very intervention. And the Hill is being distributed on the Congress. Mm. I found very interesting this effect. You know, in 25 years of existence of this approach and dozens of hospital successes, no failure period, those who approach this, there was nobody in 25 years, nobody argue with that. I have not heard a single person who would say that is wrong or cannot be implemented for one reason or another. Just the silence.
Yes.
I call it cutting through a sour cream. There is no resistance and no slice.
Oh, boy. Okay. So we're moving ahead because we're running out of time. But I do want to say there's a book about you and your life who people who are watching this podcast can get a hold of in bookstores and via Amazon. And can you tell us briefly about this book?
Let me do that. If you allow me to do another share.
Yes.
That's a book.
There it is.
You mentioned.
Yes, Hospital Heal Thyself.
Yeah. The author is Mark Taylor. I always, when I talk about this book, to be able to promote it because I really like it. I always say that I'm not taking a penny out of the proceeds of selling this book. That allows me to be objective.
Yes.
And this book, the idea of this book is to discuss it with different people, those who implemented, who did not implement it. The author interviewed leading people, the former head of CMS, the former head of Institute of Medicine, many hospital CEOs, surgeons, nurses, patient advocates. And the answer was uniform, that it works at every place.
Yes.
So I think it's beneficial for those who want to introduce it for the C-suites.
Yes.
I can tell you personally, it is beneficial to myself.
Yes.
Because I gave it to my wife to show that I'm doing something useful in my life, you know.
Okay. Our next question, we're going to zip along here. I know that you have little control over insurance companies. Now, insurance companies are a real problem today. It's a hot button topic among doctors and undoubtedly among health providers, hospitals specifically, because they're dropping insurance companies. I won't mention any, but I know of two large insurance providers that are being dropped by hospital systems. And that makes big problems for patients. So can you tell us about that? Why are hospital costs continually increasing and insurance companies driving everybody crazy.
So if I'm a representative of the insurance company, the hospitals can improve in efficiency, definitely can improve efficiency, I should have said. And they're in a difficult position, not just because they're inefficient, because there are objective reasons that reduction in Medicaid, for example, reimbursement. So if I'm in the, with the insurance company and I see that that increased, I'm not going to subsidize the hospital. So I have to transfer this cost to the employers and charge them more for the premium. And as an insurance leader, I'm look at this and say, how about if I get a piece of my piece of cake out of it and I increase my overhead? So if the cost of the hospital increases, I will increase my charges as well. And that I would transfer to the employers and say, that's a hospital fault. They increase the cost. What can I do? So they get their piece of the pie.
I see the, that, yes. They're become very profitable, the insurance, the health insurance companies. And we've heard that significantly, significantly over the past several months. Now, I'm going to speed ahead. Do you agree that hospitals are not 24/7 entities as originally planned?
I agree. It's not 24/7, definitely. If you ask me whether I'm happy with this, I would say no.
Huh.
But I can tell you, we cannot make hospitals today even 24/5 in terms of elective admission, not 24/7.
Yes.
How about 5 days a week?
And the next question I have for you, and if hospitals admit everybody, and, you know, we're obligated to treat everybody, and I think that the politicians have said this, we are legally unable to screen patients economically. And I don't think I would want to do that. You know, we who give care to the poor, to those who have money, we don't screen them economically. So if that's the case, how can hospitals be profitable, especially if there's no federal reimbursement to the hospitals?
Yeah. First of all, the federal reimbursement should be increased. But by how much? That's an area of science. If you smooth flow, you will know exactly how many beds do we need today? How many nurses do we need today? If you ask today at the hospital, please give me the number of beds, additional beds you need, and tell me 5 telemetry, 10 med-surg, etc., you will not get this answer.
Yes.
Because they don't know. If you come to the bank and want to borrow money, they will ask you how much, what this is for. You tell them, I don't know. How much you will get?
Yes, yes. Very true. Very, very true. So my last question, because we are running out of time, and this is a critical question. This question really is sort of sums everything up. Why don't all hospitals implement these interventions and become more scientific if these techniques are practically proven to be so beneficial? What needs to be done? And who should do it? Should this become law, or should this be, you know, I'm referring to the rural hospitals who are really in trouble right now with no federal monies or minimal federal monies. And now these monies are becoming less and less. What do we do?
Don't forget, please, that I came from the former Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. So I prefer a carrot over a stick. So I think the hospital will benefit dramatically. What needs to be done? First of all, education, education, education. Media, government, American Hospital Association should do their part, educating hospitals about this opportunity to show that everybody, including surgeons who hospital C-suite frequently is afraid of, that they demand beneficiaries. So again, education, education, and education. Nobody is talking about that. We are talking about AI and who is going to be paid. Is it going to be personal health saving account or it's AI? None of them. If you have those peaks in patient flow, you may use your AI until the cows come home. You still will have those peaks. And as long as you have them, then you'll have all these consequences.
Okay, well, those are perfect last comments. Is there anything that we've forgotten to mention that you'd like to say before we close?
I'm not ready to answer this question. Otherwise, I would think, you know, how I can impress my wife, but I'm not ready to answer.
All right, Dr. Litvak, this has been a real pleasure. And I hope this film and this interview goes far and wide and is reviewed by people in the C-suites, as you say, which means the administrations of various hospitals and institutions, and perhaps even a few politicians should really listen to this. Those who are involved in Medicare, Medicaid funding, and indeed even Obamacare. I think everyone needs to understand what the problems are, which I assume and I see have been ignored by just about everybody, and the numbers are going through the roof, as you said. We're going to be trillions upon trillions upon trillions of dollars in the future, and it isn't going to necessarily improve medical care. So I want to thank you for being our guest today, and I want to say that it has been a real pleasure to understand all of the nuances of hospitals and their problems.
Well, pleasure is mine, and I really appreciate this invitation. I mean it.
Thank you.
And it's a real pleasure to be on your great podcast, which I watch regularly.
Thank you. And thanks to all of you viewing for being and listening to this wonderful description of our healthcare and our healthcare problems. Thank you again.
Thank you for joining us on Health Frontiers. I hope today's episode provided valuable insights into your well-being. Remember, this podcast is not a substitute for professional medical advice, but a source of knowledge and guidance. If you have any questions or topics you'd like us to cover, please reach out. Make sure to like, subscribe, and visit our website at www.healthfrontierspod.com. Join us next time as we continue our quest to uncover the latest in health and wellness. Stay healthy and empowered. Until next time, I'm Dr. Bob.